Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I am your host, Oana Oiorean, a Romanian writer and translator living in Belgium. We are here today with Sophie Lewis to talk about her new book, Abolish the Family, a manifesto for care and liberation out from Verso. Hi, Sophie. How are you today?
Hi, Oana. I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
Would you like to quickly introduce yourself, talk about some of the stuff you have written previously and your general practice?
Oh, thank you. Sure. So my name is Sophie Lewis. I did quite a lot of time in academia. I studied English literature as an undergraduate at Oxford. Then I switched to environmental policy at the same place. Then I had a Fulbright scholarship and studied politics at the New School for Social Research in New York. And finally, I did a PhD in human geography with two eco-Marxist supervisors who I sort of applied to be supervised by, thinking I wanted to really study the production of nature and nature as an accumulation strategy, as the late great Neil Smith called it, as well as the illustrious history of anti-work. So I had very grand ambitions to think about work and nature together. And what ended up happening was that I looked at gestational labor, as I call it, contract pregnancy, the commercial gestational surrogacy industry, and also unwaged pregnancy during my PhD. And after that, I basically kind of slowly fell out of formal academia and wrote a book, Full Surrogacy Now, Feminism Against Family. That was my first book with Verso Books 2019. And it makes an argument that tries to unite these anti-work horizons I mentioned with a kind of, Marxist geographical exploration of the actually existing very dystopic rather than utopian landscape of commercialized gestating. And because of the success, the sort of unexpected success of Full Surrogacy Now, I have been able since then to become what I wanted to be when I was a kid, which is a writer. And I've written essays and given sort of talks, all over the world at this point. And my subjects of interest are quite varied. I've written for, kind of infamously, for N+1, a literary magazine based in New York, about octopuses and erotophobia and the erotic. I've written for the London Review of Books about the history of women and alcohol. I've written for Harper's Magazine about Marilyn Monroe. So, there's a lot of different topics that I turn my sort of attention to. But even in all of these areas, I am ongoingly fascinated by what anti-work horizons mean in the very vexed question of care work. I would say that that's my sort of red thread running through everything. What does anti-work in care work look like? How does the redistributive or qualitative transformation of that labor work? but of course I don't always, you know, write about cultural topics. Sometimes I actually, can you edit this, Oana? Are you able to cut certain kinds of waffle
no, I have
out
to,
or not?
I can tell them. I can tell them to cut it. I can ask the people at the New Books Network to edit it maybe, but what do you want edited out?
Oh, I see. I'm sorry. Just that last, I just realized I should have shut up the last few seconds. You know, I should have, when you opened your mouth to follow up, I should have just shut up.
No, go ahead. I love listening to you. And as a side note to our listeners, that octopus essay that she mentioned is just amazing. I really, really loved it. But before we start, so now you ended up with family abolitionism, which is also actually anti-work politics, let's put it that way. But before we start on it, can you tell me about the book's dedication to the West Philadelphia Cemetery Commune? Because it really drew my attention.
Oh, the dedication. No one's asked me about that. Gosh. Yeah, well, to be honest, that refers to the combination of sort of visa wedding and collective, you know, omnidirectional marriage ceremony that my partner and I had with many of our comrades, where the ritual practice was a surprise to all of us. It was directed by one of our closest loved ones, and you know, she invited everyone who felt interested in participating in that to sort of get married to everybody else around the two of us. So it was a kind of, you know, we don't imagine that we escaped the relationship with the state that is marriage. However, to the extent that we were able to throw a party, which is the nice part of marriage, we made it a sort of participatory ritual that we didn't really control very much in advance. And everybody ended up sort of quote unquote, you know, marrying themselves to everyone else. That's
nice.
That's what the dedication is.
So on that note, let's start with the rest of the book. Let's talk about how we, the left, are trying to take grandma away, and what you call the scariness in all real revolutionary politics.
Yes. Thanks. That's such a great way of phrasing the question, Oana. I mean, yeah, I write in my little manifesto, Abolish the Family, that I simultaneously want to address, take seriously, and respect, but also, you know, not shy away from, you know, I want to assuage, but also to simply recognize the scariness of any sort of serious commitment to the communization of social relations and of the world, especially of care. Because, you know, if we want the world to change utterly, you know, for me, communism with a small c, very close to what Ruthie Wilson Gilmore calls abolition. In fact, I think she says as much, right? The ruthless sort of criticism of everything existing goes to, you know, is part of the real movement that abolishes the present state of things. We have to be willing to understand that that includes us, that includes our very subjectivities, our consciousness, our identities, our sense of self, the way we are manufactured as, you know, quote unquote individuals, is currently the family. And so, you know, asking people to think critically about that anthrogenetic process, anthrogenesis is the word I'm currently thinking about, to simply mean the, you know, the production of human beings, human bodies. You know, we have to be able to at least suspend that discomfort and that fear, I think, recognizing that, well, according to Kathy Weeks, the anti-work philosopher and feminist who has written very generatively about the history of family abolition and feminism recently in the journal Feminist Theory, we may not currently be fully able to, let alone desire, the post-familial, post-capitalist future. We may not even be able to fully desire it in the present, and yet we can orient ourselves towards it. It's a long, long road. The radical poet Diane de Prima talks about, you know, in one of her poems in the Revolutionary Letters, she talks about picking up the work, you know, someone else will finish. That's the kind of, you know, not necessarily melancholic kind of long haul that we're talking about if we want to be serious about transforming not just the, you know, the traditional factory that Marx revealed as the hidden abode of production, but also what Jordi Rosenberg calls the hiddener abode, the social factory, the family, right? The naturalized, invisibilized workplace that is, you know, very much a part of the cycle of capital accumulation and which also needs to be revolutionized. But with, you know, even on the left, we're very protective of the naturalness, you know, the supposed naturalness of that sphere. And so when you ask, you know, why the left is taking grandma away, you know, unfortunately, for several decades, it hasn't, right? I mean, I'm joking. No one's grandma should be taken away. Family, you know, abolition is not about the separation of people. On the contrary, it is about the possibility of being together, being joined together for the first time in history, I would say. But, you know, the horizon and the language and the demand of abolition of the family was present during the Red Decade, the long 60s. And it was also known, you know, in the era of the sort of left Bolshevik, you know, the left-wing dissident wing of the Bolsheviks' kind of attention to this, Alexandra Kollontai and so on, and the people to the left of the Bolsheviks at the time also. And then, you know, you could even go back a century before that and think about the utopian socialism of Charles Fourier, which inspired Marx and Engels in the Communist Manifesto to talk about abolition of the family, the supposed, like, infamous proposal of the communists. But, you know, when you ask me whether today the left is mounting that kind of threat, you know, to subjectivity, to people's sort of comfort zones, I would say, unfortunately, no. The imagination has successfully been shrunk, I think, by the 80s, you know, stomping of the new left into the dust, right? And to some extent, it's never quite come back. It's never quite recovered, I would say, from that defeat.
Yes, so I'm gonna get back to you on that later on. But first, I would like to go on with two quotes from your book, which really resonated with me. One, family values are bourgeois economics writ small, and relate to that the family is a miserable way to organize care. And tell me more, why do you think the nuclear capitalist family is doing a bad job at care? I'm particularly interested as a parent. You also say that parenthood is an absurdly unfair distribution of labor and of power. And I totally agree with that because I struggle with both these aspects. I catch myself facilitating my children's accommodation to capitalism, as you say, even as I try to help them dream utopically.
Yes, yes, that's so well put. The innovation that, you know, certain dissident Marxist feminists made in the early 70s with this category of social reproduction and its politics, you know, it's often been kind of misunderstood by some in academia and theory as a matter of praise, right? Social reproductive labor is crucial to the reproduction of capitalism. It's crucial to the survival of capitalist society. And, you know, that's not praise. That is not moral praise. Reproducing the world as it is nothing to be super proud of. Kathy Weeks's anti-work kind of diagnosis is so important here. We are unable to hear something that identifies labor as anything other than moral praise, you know, as and yet that was not the point. The point was to make something visible in order to be able to abolish it. When you talk about sort of accommodating your children to capitalism, naturalizing capitalism for them, that's something that you have very little choice but to do, right? Very little choice. In fact, maybe no real choice but to do. And there's this duality, right? You're in all social reproduction, we're reproducing the world as it is and reproducing, you know, people who are not entirely within capitalism. We're reproducing comrades and we're reproducing workers at the same time. And that complexity, you know, is what we have to grasp, right? It's a nettle we have to grasp politically. And we have to be able to move as a left beyond the ongoing reluctance to think about, you know, revolutionizing that intimate sphere and taking it seriously, perhaps prioritizing it really, in a sense. The family is doing a bad job at care, in the sense of, you know, flourishing among human beings, right? It's not doing such a terrible job in terms of caring for the needs of the market and the state. That's, you know, that's one sort of specification you have to give, right? It's an unbelievably bananas, to use a technical term, distribution of responsibility, power, and labor. It maximizes labor for us in a way, while giving, you know, maximum profit and benefit to our bosses, you know, and our governments who need to administer us tidily, and surveil us to an extent in these administrative units that we've created, the private nuclear household. That there's great profit to be generated from the isolation of people within private nuclear households. And there are all kinds of dimensions to that. Some of the most obvious ones are just the multiplication of, you know, commodities and consumer needs. The fact that every household has a laundry, every household, you know, has a kitchen and so on. In the past, you know, there were even moments of social democratic state realization that this is, you know, totally illogical. The UK government stated officially during World War II that private production of food, you know, for private consumption is not just nutritionally non-optimal, but sort of economically and socially irrational. And so, you know, you have these moments where the illogic of the private nuclear household kind of peeks through, even because of the war, right? The wartime suspension of, you know, capitalist business as usual to an extent. So these huge dining halls and canteens were kind of rolled out to give millions of people the experience of, you know, fine communal dining, you know, three times a day. which really changes people's subjectivity and their sense of what their needs are. And I wanted to kind of, you know, offer you this sense of needs as one of the central rubrics for family abolitionist struggle, enlarging our sphere of needs as the practical task. The welfare rights militants of the US in the 80s used this language. They talked about growing rich in needs. And I think it's a useful way of sort of helping people think about what might be at stake. Currently, we direct our needs towards the private realm almost exclusively to be met, right? Whether it's, you know, emotional needs or physical needs, spiritual needs, you know, needs for therapeutic care and so on. We direct our needs into private arenas, right? Often commodified because a large proportion of social reproductive labor has been commodified under neoliberalism, right? The family nevertheless persists, as Melinda Cooper has so aptly sort of laid out in her book, Family Values, which is about how neoliberalism and neoconservatism basically hold hands in reproducing and relying on the family, which is not nearly dead enough, despite the story being that it's on the threat of collapse, you know, and that's been the story for literally millennia. Something about the family is always on the brink of collapse discursively. That's part of its functioning as a technology, as a sort of material, ideological and juridical technology for the ordering of populations. Yeah, I might have lost my thread a little bit there, Oana. Too many.
No, that's great. That's great. I think you touched on the main points. But to get back to, let's say, abolitionist politics, you also explain in the book why merely calling for an expanded family or a reformed family, which might be more palatable for some, rather than straight away to abolish, is not enough. Could you sum up that argument for us?
Yeah. Well. Okay. It makes no sense to call for the expansion of organized scarcity. If you recognize that, you know, the family, which I define as the form that the privatization of care takes in a class society, you know, i.e. the societies we've known up till now, you know, it makes no sense to talk about, you know, expanding or reforming that. You have to abolish it. I'm interested in the specificity of the term abolish. It's not designed to upset people. Abolish is a very, you know, special word because of its simultaneous meanings of transformation, destruction, you know, and realization. Of course, there is a destructive element there. I think we have to be able to face that, the negation that is necessary of the sorts of, you know, sentimental and material priority, the ideological cult, you know, of familism, the notion that, you know, genetics is real, right? That we really do in fact reproduce ourselves, and that we gain immortality, not to mention sort of property in our children. These are fantasies that we need to be able to, you know, negate and criticize, I think. And there is a destructive element. But the transformative element of abolition, and paradoxically, the realization of the promise of, you know, the dystopic present, that's what I want to talk about in a sense. You know, when you talk about prison abolition, which, you know, thanks to the uprisings of recent years has become, you know, a very well-known common sense topic, you know, miraculously enough, it's not sufficiently, you know, talked about, because, you know, abolition is quite a, in a sense, you know, quite a scholarly term of art, right? But, you know, in a sense, people are talking about it at the same time. They're recognizing that the promise of the, you know, criminal justice system, justice, is a travesty in the present, right? And if you burn down all the prisons today, which is not, you know, not something that I think would be a bad idea necessarily, but it would not be prison abolition. We would not have abolished the criminal justice system by doing that, you know, or by disarming every cop or whatever. Abolition is the process of building the thing that was being travestied. So justice. It's actually not about beginning in those buildings. It's actually about beginning everywhere else, such that, you know, the current forms wither away and become unthinkable. The same goes for the family, right? I don't suggest, this is my little joke, don't try this at home, kids. You know, family abolition is not something you go home and, you know, try and, you know, transform, you know, relationships for in the currently existing private nuclear households of the 21st century, right? No, it's actually, in a sense, probably going to end up sounding quite bread and butter, you know, like, you know, social justice struggles and, you know, left movements, right? Anything that directs our needs into the common sphere, anything that provides for people infrastructures of nurturance, whether it's, you know, food, whether it's forms of, you know, education or therapy or healthcare, you know, free transit, the right to the city, stuff that meets people's needs outside of the private sphere. That's what I'm talking about when I talk about the path. And so whether people want to hear it or not, and whether it's a good thing or not in their minds, a lot of actually existing campaigns and mutual aid networks and movements are already sort of, you know, abolishing the family by making it possible to have people's needs met outside of their families. But I would, yeah, that's what I'm sort of saying about the need to think about abolition rather than expansion or reform, because, you know, the tricky thing is, of course, the family has many different meanings. I insist, you know, on defining it, which is quite valid and certainly has a lot of precedent, right, in academia, but it's the form that the privatization of care takes currently under capitalism. And that it's not a synonym, you know, of, you know, kinship practices. However, we can talk a little bit more about how I think that the language and metaphor of kin, kin making and kinship ultimately, you know, has two strong ties to the family as a property form to be particularly useful, I think, for truly liberatory politics. But I'm not, you know, I'm obviously not suggesting that well, I hope it's obvious. I think it is, you know, that I'm not suggesting that the sort of relationships that people have that they might use familial language to think about are somehow, you know, wrong or bad. I cannot stress enough, you know, the family is a sort of shield that people take up, you know, to survive a war. And, you know, we don't really have a choice, to be honest. Especially racialized, marginalized, colonized people, you know, who had the family imposed on them via, for example, the Freedmen's Bureau, you know, in the United States, imposed, you know, marriage on the descendants of captive peoples once after emancipation, or, you know, the Bureau of Indian Affairs imposed, you know, male-headed patriarchal property owning household forms on, you know, the indigenous people of North America. And in the wake of that, right, there is a particularly, you know, acute sort of desirability for family abolition, a proximity to it, a deserving of it, and a long history, in a sense, of resistance to the imposition of family, right? But there's also, you know, a particularly acute sort of forced attachment to it for survival. the family is truly the only thing that people have got going on for the purposes of survival in the present. That's what makes it such a visceral, painful sort of thing to talk about trying to, you know, unseat, you know, to almost like rip it out from our very bodies. You know, it's a truly, truly terrifying, you know, philosophical and political proposition. And I think I'm attentive enough to that. Although it's never going to be easy. Who knows?
You have a very helpful section in the book that sort of reviews practical attempts at abolishing the family, from structurally queer living to state policy. You talk about black non-nuclear kinning and polymaternalism. We have had the Genotel. You've already mentioned Alexandra Kollontai, also one of my favorite revolutionaries. We've had wages for housework and against housework. And I don't know if you're following at all. More recently, we have the new Cuban family code, which seems to expand the family or what the family means. But yeah. It's definitely, yes, you want to comment on that? I'm wondering if this can come from above, or it's sort of the kind of politics that has to come from below before we can actually
achieve.
Yes,
I think that's a great question. I think we should touch on it briefly. I'd love to hear your thoughts too, Oana, on the Cuban family code. It seems to me that, you know, my argument is for an abolition process from below. However, you know, there are conditions of possibility that are more and less favorable, right, for the sorts of communization of care, you know, that we're interested in. I think the Cuban family code struck me personally as a very desirable step. And I was interested in the processes that were quite, democratic, the referenda that kind of generated it and seemed to channel people's real desires for the way they wanted to live and relate and be recognized, by the state. So I felt that it probably helps produce, you know, not just appetite, but material, you know, conditions of possibility for more radical practices and processes. It perhaps educates people's desire, to be asked, you know, even in a top-down manner, you know, how do you think people should relate to one another? As Tiffany Letabo King keeps reminding us, you know, there are other ways of naming ourselves as relations, and perhaps the kind of rather unusual opportunity of being asked, yeah, let's remake this. What do you want, you know, as a population, can help spark the kind of process of really, utopically continuing and expanding that sphere of need and desire. But I'm not the expert on how it's all been playing out. Did you have anything to add yourself?
I'm not an expert either, but I agree with what your first impression is, and especially in the context of what's been going on in Chile, where they also try to sort of move towards less conservative ways of understanding family existence and so on, where it failed for reasons that don't have that much to do with the policy, but rather with the particular dynamics over there. It was great to see what was going on in Cuba, and I'm excited to keep an eye on that and to see where it's going and how it unfolds. And on that note, I also loved the section at the end of the book, an amazing section about what abolishing the family will actually look like. And I will quote you again because I love this quote. If we hold hands, we can certainly be brave enough to step into the abundance that will be the nothingness that comes after the family. Maybe you want to expand on that, and also on, because you mentioned vocabulary, on kin, kith, and comradeliness.
Yeah. Well, I borrow this directly, really, as an answer to the question, you know, what will come after the family? because it's really what people want to know. From the Marxist socialists, Mary McIntosh and Michelle Barrett, who in the darkness of Thatcherism, you know, wrote this very elegant theoretical and political statement on family abolition called The Antisocial Family. And it was published by Verso as well. So I always imagine Margaret Thatcher, you know, triumphantly sort of, you know, extending her deeply familist form of capitalism, you know, over the land and saying, not really incorrectly, you know, there is no such thing as society. There are individual men and women and there are families, right? Her famous quote. And I always think of Michelle Barrett and Mary McIntosh kind of answering, well, yeah, the reason why the first part is true, you know, that the social has been destroyed, you know, by capitalism, is the last part, the family. It's a technology for destroying sociality. I think it's a very elegant kind of argument. So they're saying that the social is really what we build when we turn away from the family, ultimately. And it is, you know, the family that is kind of sucking up our understandings of how needs can be met by being associated with all good things, you know, nice things to eat, mother love, belonging, you know, the pleasures of, you know, identity formation collectively, like ethnic tradition, you know, all sorts of pleasures and things that people associate and develop purely within the realm of kinship. And so, yeah, they say that people were always asking them, you know, what could possibly come after the family, and they insist on saying nothing. You know, you don't replace something, you know, that steals us away from each other. You don't replace that. And I think it's a lovely answer. And so I basically reproduce it and say, it's the nothingness outside of the family that we need to start understanding as abundant. You know, it is a very difficult thing to trust, you know, emotionally, but it is what we must learn to trust and what we must develop conditions of possibility for trusting, for being able to rely upon. Because actually, you know, this comes down to trust in labor, funnily, right? The forms that family gives are forms of sort of state and juridical and ideological sort of biologized sanction that make us imagine that the ties that we have with one another are unbreakable, except by God or perhaps, you know, some lengthy administrative process with the state where, you know, like a child breaking up with their parents is called emancipation, right? You know, or we can get divorces more classically, you know, but the idea is that a tie of family creates a space that even the state cannot penetrate. That's a very alluring fantasy, and it's a great offer to people, right? That a person's home, a man's, you know, safest refuge, a home, his home is his castle. This is a juridical principle that was invented, you know, I think in the 15th or 14th centuries in the UK, I can't remember. And it kind of informs settler colonialism, this idea that, you know, if someone comes onto your private familial property, you know, trespassing, you are absolutely morally sanctioned to commit any kind of violence against them in the name of your kids, in the name of your wife. This is a sacred form of violence, you know, that comes with the family, in fact. It's one of the ways in which the family is a state institution, not just a market servicing cell. It's the way in which, as, you know, the property owner of that space, in fantasy, you are an emissary of the state. You have the, you know, the control over the legitimate means or the legitimate use of violence. And so you'll find in all kinds of really strange places, people's kind of recognition of this poking through, you know, unconsciously. Like the liberal feminist philosopher Kate Mann talks at the end of her book entitled about her, you know, willingness to kill for her daughter. And she immediately says she realizes she's not, you know, she's not actually entitled to do that. But it's such a strange thing. I think it's part of the payoff that we get out of parenthood in capitalist society. It is genuinely a form of, you know, consolation. You get to be a tiny little bit of the state. And if anyone, you know, crosses your threshold uninvited, you know, that state sanctioned violence is actually, you know, yours, you know, to determine and to mete out if necessary. But of course, you know, this whole setup, this invitation, this promise about the family is a lie, isn't it? It's never been actually available to proletarian families, racialized families, black and, you know, immigrant, you know, indigenous families. The state does penetrate those boundaries all the time. You know, the monstrosities of the child protective services, you know, apparatuses, the very long and blood-stained history of state child removal, you know, the settler colonial stealing of children, the ongoing, you know, process of separating people from one another forcibly at the border, you know, and the general sort of surveillance and policing and transgression of those thresholds, you know, of in particular in the US, black intramural life has meant that for some, the phrase black family in the context of the United States is an oxymoron, right? There is no black family in the eyes of the state. It has never respected that boundary, right? And so in that sense, you know, those who have the most need, in a sense, who are clinging sometimes for survival, sometimes recognizing, however, that, you know, there never was anything in the family for them, you know, that there has been, you know, sorry, excuse me, I lost my train, there's been a recognition that, you know, I think it's a phrase from the abolitionist sort of anti-police, anti-prisons movement, you know, there's no justice, there is just us. It sounds like a sort of scary thing, but the sooner we realize in a sense that, you know, nothing, not the family, not the state, nothing is coming to rescue us or validate us or sanction us or catch us, you know, perhaps the better. Because it is in fact labor every day that creates relationships, right? Kinship is always made, not given. And it is our fantasy that we will be automatically cared for because of some kind of legal or biogenetic reality that is non-contingent, that undergirds that, that we need to be able to, I think, suspend, put to one side. You know, guess what? you know, the most, you know, formal, official ties are nevertheless actually only given shape through a decision every day, you know, to enact them via labor. And so, you know, we're already as precarious as we could possibly be, which is the good and bad news. And so that's what I mean about stepping forward into that scariness together, holding hands and recognizing that, you know, that it is, you know, our labors that creates relationships. Even if we make containers for some of those, you know, and I'm not saying that we might not, you know, decide to make forms of belonging and name them, you know, and I'm certainly not against somehow the intimate sphere, right? but I think what is needed, especially, you know, in the transition is an an especially strong emphasis on the fact that, you know, it's us making these forms every day, not some sort of story about blood or seed or gene or marriage or what have you.
Right. You mentioned earlier in the interview that you're not very optimistic about the present family abolitionism moment. And I was curious to know, because you're just back from your European book tour, I think. You were in Europe to promote the book. And you mentioned in your book that while for a while it was the central demand of women's liberation, it was first defeated and actively erased. But you say in the book, now we are again in a moment of abolition fervor. Should I understand that this extends to the family as well, or do you refer to other types of abolitionisms, like police and prison abolitionism is clearly catching on in Europe as well. But I'm curious if you have something hopeful to say about what you noticed among the comrades in Europe.
Oh, yeah, I was astonished and humbled and delighted at how much, you know, there was clearly conversation going on, not just about my work, but, you know, also reading my work, but just extending it, applying it, developing it around abolition of the family. I would say that in the US, there was perhaps a moment when I was writing the manifesto, where I thought that people were extremely amenable, you know, to the recognition that, you know, the private sphere would have to be, you know, transformed along with the criminal justice complex and so on. Because, frankly, of COVID and the highlighting of the crisis of care that the pandemic, you know, affected. But I do think that there's been, at least in the US, a bit of a kind of reversal of that and a sense that people want to go back to quote unquote normal. I have no idea whether that once again will be shaken off, you know, hopefully any minute now. But yeah, I think I'm a little bit less optimistic about, you know, the creativity and experimental courage that people, you know, on a mass level seem to be manifesting around familism. But when I said abolition fervor, I think I was imagining that the police and prison applications might spread, right? There are fascinating conversations happening among those who study the, you know, abolition of family policing, Dorothy Roberts, Dean Spade, and so on, and how that goes hand in hand potentially with, you know, abolition of the family, right? These are the sorts of dialectic complexity that we need to be getting very good at holding in our minds. You know, you can, you know, defend people who happen to be in families against brutalities and atrocities like the family policing, you know, edifice, and at the same time denaturalize the family. In fact, we can and must, and maybe latently people are already, in a sense, doing that. You can defend a queer kid inside a migrant family against her relatives who may or may not be, you know, if they are, you know, brutalizing her if she needs to escape, you know, and you can at the same time defend all of those people, that family, against brutalization by the state, right? These are not impossible things. We do not have to march under banners that naturalize, you know, the sanctity of family. We don't have to, I think, you know, proclaim that families, quote unquote, belong together, and that the thing that we want to stop is family separation. I'm not, you know, I have marched under those banners, you know, like any decent person, you know, to protest the violence of the border apparatus in the, you know, in the United States. But I think really it's quite easy to make that switch. People recognize that what they actually mean is, you know, stop the brutalization of people, or perhaps even, you know, disarm the border, you know, abolish the border, you know, stop separating human beings, stop, you know, preventing people who want to be together from being together. The whole language and idiom of family is supposed to be a respectable lever, I think, a reproach to the system of power that supposedly welcomes and respects legitimate, quote unquote, you know, families once they present themselves. The fantasy is that once admitted, they will be, you know, afforded all of the sort of wages of familiality that America offers to families. But this just, you know, this isn't how it works, right? And that veil can quite readily and easily be pierced, in my opinion.
Thank you. I think we've taken up already a lot of your time. But before we finish, I would like to know what you're working on now. I think you've recently announced that you're starting work on a new book.
Yes. Yes, I'm writing a book that is tentatively, well, it's either going to be called Bad Feminisms or Enemy Feminisms, or potentially The Feminism of Fools, How Some Feminisms Hinder Feminist Liberation. And the phrase, you know, feminism of fools is a reference to the phrase socialism of fools, which is, you know, an analysis that I find very useful about the truncation of anti-capitalist critique. So what people meant when they said that was, in the 19th century, was that people have a little bit of an inkling about capitalism, and they take a wrong turn and start talking about Jews. So this is the socialism of fools, where you end up on the wrong side of history. You become an enemy for having, you know, become familiar with a couple of concepts of radical or structural analysis. So truncated anti-capitalist critique is more dangerous, becomes fascism. Because so the socialism of fools is anti-Semitism. My analogy, and it is going to, you know, be an imperfect metaphor, but the feminism of fools is where people end up in very carceral, potentially, you know, violently annihilationist anti-trans sorts of positions, historically also eugenic positions, nationalist, imperialist sorts of positions, having, you know, realized often in quite sort of fervent ways that something is wrong with regard to sex and gender on this planet, which it is, you know. But I want to make an intervention where I look at, I'm thinking six different archetypes. That's my plan currently, but I keep adding more chapters, where I explore the history of feminism as in an almost like warts only way. I do think that there's been a proliferation of books recently about the failures of quote unquote white feminism, right? It's become extremely, you know, I almost want to say fashionable, to denounce and to criticize white feminism. And I think a lot of those books are useful. Some of them perhaps a bit less so, some of them excellent. But I also think actually there is maybe more to say. There's actually more to say than identifying and denouncing white feminism, because in fact, it's not just the whiteness, although the whiteness comes up in all, I think, of the bad feminisms that I'm looking at. It's also not a question for me of denouncing and disavowing for the sake of a purification of feminism. Rather, I want to clarify the terrain so that instead of, as I did as a teenager, constantly assuming that, you know, the feminisms that we see that are reactionary are somehow, quote unquote, not real feminisms. You know, that's a very tempting move. I've made it a lot of times myself. A lot of people like to say this, you know, TERFs are not real feminists, or, you know, that's not real feminism. In fact, this isn't working out. This isn't getting us very far. I think I'm hoping to contribute something that makes it really clear that the history of feminism is so capacious as to contain within itself its own enemies. And there really are enemy feminisms, which is not to say that there are probably any totally, quote unquote, unproblematic, you know, angelic feminisms or something. But I do think that some level of confusion could be averted by identifying the ones that are actually in and of themselves anti-liberatory. So I have a chapter on the femo-nationalist, a chapter on the white slave, a chapter on the adult human female, a chapter on the hetero-pessimist, actually, although I think that might be less enemy than sort of, you know, mistake. I've got one on the dirt bag, and of course I've got one on the girl boss, who in some senses is a bit of a, you know, a dated figure at this point, although I think I want to argue less so than we might wish. and I want to also articulate a kind of critical utopianist feminism in the tradition of feminism against cisness, which my you know, my friend and comrade and, you know, the extremely brilliant Emma Heaney talks about. This is her phrase, feminism against cisness, and an anthology is forthcoming soon with Duke under that title. I'm hoping that in every chapter I manage to, you know, convey the struggles that are also, you know, doing this same terrain completely differently. So I'm going to be speaking about feminists against cisness in my chapter on adult human females, you know, and I'm going to be talking about anti-imperialist feminist struggles in my chapter about femo-nationalists and so on. Thank you for asking.
Thank you, Sophie, for taking the time to talk to me today. And to our listeners, do get Sophie's book out now from Verso, as well as her previous book, Full Surrogacy Now, soon also available in Romanian in my translation from Fractalia. And also make sure to look for everything Sophie writes, because in the tradition of great communist writing, her sentences are also a complete delight. I am Oana Oioran, and I wish you a great day. Bye-bye.